I've never run the 100 metres confession there.
One man shocked himself 191 times.
Behaviour change at its fundamental level is identity change. Hello and welcome back to the Waterstones podcast. It's a new year, a new season of the podcast, but some things remain the same. Great authors, great books, and great chats around a theme in each episode. To begin 2020, we don't want to fall into the trap of new year, new you, shaming you into gym membership or diet plans or unrealistic life goals. We're taking the theme of changes to allow us to talk to Emily Dean about her frank, funny, and inspiring memoir, Everyone Died, So I Got a Dog. To Claudia Hammond about The Art of Rest, in which we discover why rest is as important as sleep. And in the studio, we're joined by one of the most influential doctors in the country. You may have seen him on the BBC, listened to his podcast, Feel Better, Live More, or read one of his books on health and stress relief. His latest book, Feel Better in 5, presents a daily plan that begins with just 5 minutes of your time, but might just change your life. An idea I can completely get behind. It's great to have Dr. Rangan Chatterjee with us. Welcome, Rangan.
Thank you very much for having me on your podcast.
It's an absolute pleasure. I'm also here with Holly too. Happy New Year, Holly.
Happy New Year.
How was Christmas?
It was so great, thank you. It was wonderful.
Shall we confess?
It's December.
It's December. We're recording this, of course, before New Year, so we don't know what's going to happen at Christmas. We don't know what's going to happen at New Year. Do you like Christmas? Are you a Christmas fan?
I absolutely love it.
Actually, you've said before, haven't you? You love Christmas dinner, basically, don't you?
Food, yeah.
Yeah. How about you, Rangan?
I love Christmas, yeah. Absolutely love it. I've got 2 young kids, so I think if you don't like Christmas, which I always have, but you know, having 2 young kids will bring Christmas to life for you anyway.
How old are your kids now?
9 and I was going to say 6, but my daughter's just turned 7, so 9 and 7.
9 and 7.
And they are super excited, that's for sure.
Because they're very good ages for Christmas.
They really are.
How about New Year? Because New Year does have this kind of pressure leading up to it, either because you're supposed to have like the best night out on New Year's Eve, but also this thing about what you're going to achieve in the year to come. And I always find that really, really oppressive.
Yeah, I mean, in answer to your first point, I've got to say, I've been off New Year's Eve for probably over 10 years now.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, in my 20s, it was great. And, you know, well, I think, you know, in my head, it was great. The reality was, it was always a letdown.
Yeah.
Frankly, it was, you know, you'd be outside some club somewhere at an ungodly hour, can't get a cab home, and you're thinking, why have I done this exactly?
Yeah.
I think for the last few New Years, I'm not sure if this is cool or not, I don't think I've stayed up to see the New Year in, which
really?
Is...
You haven't even made it to midnight?
I haven't made it to midnight. The last two, for sure, I've not made it to midnight. So, and do you know what? I felt absolutely fantastic on New Year's Day. So
I support that. I really support that. For sure.
Yeah, I'm sort of heading that way. I do stay up till midnight, but I'm not sort of the party boy in me is in bed well before
midnight.
I think
it's probably a bit of age as well,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
You know, an experience. And if you do have kids, I think, you know, you stay up late, then the kids are still going to be up early the next morning. And I don't know. I've just gone off. I really like Christmas for me.
Yeah.
You know, even if I think back to being as a medical student in Edinburgh, we always had to, not a medical student, as a junior doctor, you had to choose, basically, the sort of unwritten rule is you either work Christmas or you work New Year.
Okay.
And you kind of, within the team, you guys kind of figure it out. For me, it was always about getting Christmas off.
Yeah.
And I was very happy working New Year. So I guess I've always preferred Christmas to New Year.
I think I might be with you on that one. Yeah. Okay, so let's think about this. This thing about New Year is that it can make people think that they need to make change in their lives and become healthier, fitter, maybe something like that. And your new book provides people with a way of doing that which isn't so oppressive. It doesn't sound like you have to kind of sign up to some kind of horrific military-style campaign to change your body. This idea of being able to do something in 5 minutes appeals to me greatly, Rangan. So could you please tell me a little bit more?
Yeah, okay. So look, I have found over and over again with patients over nearly 20 years now that the way to encourage people to make long-term change, so change that they make in the short term, but they feel good about it and they manage to continue in the long term, mm-hmm. is to make it small and to do it consistently. Now, it sounds obvious, but at this time of year, everyone wakes up on New Year's Day and thinks, okay, look, right, it's 2020. Right, this year is going to be different. I'm going to do something this January that I've never done before. And this year it's going to work in some sort of miraculous way. I'm going to buy a book that's going to help me suddenly turn my life around. And I understand that. And I've had that sentiment before, so I totally get it. But the problem is that most books and most plans around our lifestyle revolve, they rely on the idea that motivation and willpower will continue forever.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and we know that that's not true. Research shows us this, science shows us this, clinical experience shows us this, they always run out. So in fact, one of the lead behavior change authors and scientists in the world, Professor BJ Fogg, calls it the motivation wave. And you have to plan for the motivation wave. So, you know, we're here on the Waterstones podcast, right? You guys are going to have lots of health and well-being books out in January. Now, I would say that people could pretty much pick up any one of them, right? And if they follow it for a couple of weeks, they're going to feel better,
mm-hmm.
right? If they want to lose weight, they're going to lose weight. If they want to, you know, be at the gym regularly, they're going to do that. And that's fine. But as a doctor, I'm interested in, yes, having people feel good this January, but also teaching them skills so that they can feel good in February, March, April, May. And, you know, I'm conscious I am on the Waterstones podcast because this is why there's a New Year, New You market every January,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
This is why health and wellbeing books are sold in their bucket loads every January. And I guess the industry sort of takes advantage of that in some ways because people are looking for that. And why I think my book is different from pretty much every other health book out there is because, number one, it's based on almost 20 years clinical experience about what really works with people, busy people with busy lives, but also the latest behavior change science. And it's really, really clear if you want something, if you want to turn a new behavior into a long-term habit, there's a few things you've got to do. Right, you've got to make it easy. We know that when your motivation is high, like on New Year's Day, right, a behavior can be really hard to do and you'll still do it.
Mm-hmm.
But when your motivation is low, the only way you'll do a new behavior is if it's easy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why in my book, I mean, I deal with health in a 360 degree fashion. So I deal with things that are going to help your mind, so your mental health, things that are going to help move your body, but also things that are going to help nourish your heart, which we can talk about at this time. But I give people a selection of 5-minute workouts, whether it's strength, high intensity, dancing, yoga flows, and they all require no equipment. And that's the key. Every time you bring up an obstacle to that behavior, you make it much harder to do. And I'm saying to people, right, your behavior is constantly being changed by the world around you, whether you realize it or not. I have studied those tools. I have used those tools for good, and I put them into my book. So I'm saying, let's use the principles of human behavior change and use them to help improve your well-being. And for most people listening to this podcast, I can tell you that joining the gym is the worst thing they can do this January, right? Honestly, and I never used to say this, but it's become clearer and clearer to me over the past years that it makes you feel you're doing something. Right? You talk to gym owners, they'll tell you their business model relies on the fact that most people who sign up for memberships won't turn up.
Yeah.
If everyone turned up, you won't be able to get in the gym, right? I guarantee if people start following this plan 5 minutes every day. Now, another tip for behavior change is at the same time. Now, why is that important? About 56% of what me or you do in any given day is not conscious thought, it's habit, right? And the only way, or the best way, to turn a new behavior into a long-term habit is to stick it on to an existing habit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something you already do. So for years, when I used to have a little bit of a coffee habit, which I'm slowly kind of working my way through at the moment, I would weigh out my beans, put it all in the French press, and I'd put the timer on for 4 minutes, right? During those 4 minutes, I did a bodyweight workout in the kitchen. So literally, for probably about 3 years, I never missed a 4-minute bodyweight workout on any day because I was never not going to have my coffee, mm-hmm. which meant I was never not going to have my workout. But if you have to think, oh, I'll fit in stuff for my health and well-being when I've got time, you know what? Other things are going to get in the way. We all know that, right? And so this is why you say find a time. So I think the kettle going on in the morning is a brilliant time to do what I call a health snack. How do you spend 5 minutes in the morning actually doing something to, you know, calm your mind to set you up for having a happy and productive day, whether it's journaling, whether it's a 5-minute breathing practice, whether it's 5 minutes of flow. One of my patients who has stress-related migraines, she's tried meditation, she's tried everything, right? What worked for her? 5 minutes of adult coloring in books
yeah.
every morning as she put her kettle on. So the key thing she had to do before she went to bed, she had to make sure there was a journal, her colouring book, and the crayons had to be by the kettle, because if you come down and it's not there, it's very easy to do something else. Mm-hmm. So I know I'm getting overly passionate about this, but it's because I have seen this work over and over again. And actually, behaviour change at its fundamental level is identity change. Because if you can't do what you've been asked to do, you feel bad about yourself. You feel, oh man, I can't stick to plans. You know, how many people are going to buy one of the books from one of the health and wellbeing authors this January, and by the end of January, they're going to go, oh, this wasn't the one, you know, I can't stick to it, right? My program, you can absolutely stick to. Every single person, no matter how busy you are, has got 5 minutes. And this is how, it's you do 5 minutes every day at the same time. And that's the key. And I guarantee within days, you won't even be thinking that this is hard work. It will just become a part of your day.
So I've realised I've done this without even realising that's what I was doing. I wanted to do something to improve my fitness, and I thought I'll do couch to 5K. And finding the time to do that is a little bit tricky. But every Saturday and Sunday, my son has to be taken to football. And I used to be stood in this field in the freezing cold watching him play football. And I suddenly went, I could do the running now, because that would keep me warm, first of all, and it's a time that I wouldn't be doing nothing in otherwise. So now, as part of my routine of taking him to football, I also have the time to do that exercise, and now I do it without thinking.
Exactly.
So I didn't realise what I was doing was, as you said, coupling it together.
You couple it together. That's the secret. Honestly, if there's one thing people take away from this is whatever health and wellbeing plan you choose to follow this January, right? Because my job is, I'm a doctor, I just want to help people. I don't care which one they go and get. If they want to go and get something else that they feel resonates with them, that is fine. But the little tip I would give them is whatever new habit you're trying to do, right, couple it with something you already do without thinking. That's the secret to making a new behavior stick in the long term. That's not just because I said so. That's what Professor BJ Fogg, probably the world's leading expert in human behavior, that's what he says as well, right?
Okay. I'm not into arguing with professors, so I'm going to take his word for it. I'm feeling inspired and validated by that, Holly. How about you?
Absolutely.
You ready for some action in January?
Sure. Well, this year, 2019, I set myself a New Year's resolution, in inverted commas, of doing at least one park run a month. And once I got into the habit of doing that, I just wanted to continue bettering my time and bettering myself, and therefore I stuck to doing one a month, but would still go out and do a few runs in amongst that to make sure that each month my time was getting better, I was getting faster. Mm. And having that motivation really helped me.
Love it. We've heard there a little bit about how you can choose to make change in your life through very simple, 5 minutes a day. We're going to hear now from an author who's going to talk a little bit about how change can sometimes be forced upon you. We're going to hear from radio presenter, author and podcaster Emily Dean. Her memoir, Everyone Died So I Got a Dog, has potentially the most spoilery title ever and hints at the humour with which she writes about the really devastating period in her life when she lost first of all her sister, Rachel, and then her mother and father, all three of them dying in the space of just 3 years. I would love to share our whole chat, but that would actually require almost its own podcast series, because we've got to talk about lots of things. So here is an excerpt in which we spoke about the changes that were forced on her by such a total bereavement.
I certainly felt with my sister, it was a huge shock. It was, it threw my whole life off course, off balance. It forced me to go back to ground zero, essentially, and rebuild myself, I think. And I think hearing that news, I've learnt this, having done effectively a PhD in death and bereavement, and saying goodbye to people. You know, I'm an expert in goodbyes. I've always thought, when will I master a skill? I never felt I excelled at anything, but I'm brilliant at death. That's what I do now, is I know how to give people a send-off, how to spend their last moments with them. And back to your original question, I think with my sister, it's very hard to put into words, but it was fear I felt. And years ago when I was young, my dad, I remember, told me to read the C.S. Lewis book, A Grief Observed. And I never forgot, he said, no one told me grief felt so much like fear. And you know how things stay with you as a kid? Weird quotes. And my father's very into literature, so they're always stuck in my head. And it came back to me. And I thought, God, this is frightening. Mm. And that fear is so overwhelming. And I think the fear keeps you going. The fear is a kind of adrenaline. So with the initial diagnosis, when I found out my sister, we were told, as I describe in my book, but we were told that she had... I thought she'd have a couple of years to live, you know. I thought she'd have more than that. But then we discovered she had months, and then the months turned into weeks. She died 3.5 weeks after the diagnosis, and she had 2 small children. So it was horrific. But I remember that period when she was alive, that 3-week period, it felt like the preparation. I don't know this because I've never run the 100 metres, confession there. But I imagine how it would feel, you know, in that permanent warm-up state to that, that adrenaline pumping through you, preparing for an event, sort of not wanting it to come in a way. Hmm. That's how it felt. Adrenaline kept me going. That desire to keep her alive, that desire to preserve things as they were, and the crash when somebody goes is like nothing I've ever experienced. You know, that's what's so extraordinary about grief, is that it represents change in the most profound sense possible, I think, that it's possible for any human being to have, because I feel that grief is something we're all terrified of, understandably. You know, we see... It's funny how we fetishize love a lot in our society, don't we? Romantic love. And we ostracize death and grief. And yet, for me now, I think grief and love are so inseparable and so linked, because I think that happened when I realized that everybody I love will die, because a lot of the people I loved have died. And once you understand that grief and love are so linked, I found that helpful, because I realized love will always end in grief. Mm-hmm. So you have to come to terms with it.
I suppose, as you say, that they're linked in that it is only the people that you love that you will grieve when they go. Mm. You need to have that love first, don't you? Does that mean that you've been able to come to terms in a way with the grief, because you realise that the grief is itself an expression of love, and therefore that takes you back to more positive feelings of maybe of remembrance and of seeing her daughters grow up? And
I think it's difficult. And listen, if I'd have just lost someone, and if anyone is listening to this and has just lost someone, you know, feel free to throw stones at whatever listening device you're listening to this on, and saying, well, yes, it's all very well for you, you know, 7 years on. And that is absolutely right, because it's time, isn't it? And we all know that. And I think how I viewed grief, and this sounds really odd, but bear with, is as my teacher. And I always said to myself, it's not one of those teachers. I always called them Dave, and they always said, hey, I smoke weed, let's do the lessons out in the sunshine. Yeah, call me Dave. Yeah, or mate. Because you don't learn anything from Dave.
Yeah.
Whereas Madame Miller, I had a shiver thinking of her. Never forgotten anything she taught me.
Yeah.
So I realised that grief is one of those teachers. It's the very tough, usually maths or French, let's be honest, teacher. But you remember those lessons. And Dave is the movie with the friend, the sunny day in the park. It's great at the time, but I don't know how much it, it's a beautiful passing pleasure, but it's, unfortunately, it's the tough things you learn from. And that's how I saw it. So every time I would have a moment and the pain would be indescribably awful, you know, I'd be sitting there and I'd think, I'd remember. I'd sort of wake up and I'd feel happy because it was sunny, or because there was a song I liked on the radio. And then I'd remember. And that's what kills you, the remembering. Mm. And I think this was helpful for those moments. I'd think, right, okay, I have a choice. I can go under And at the point when I lost my parents, and, you know, I always call it the Game of Thrones showrunner was in charge of my life, just killing everyone off every sort of, not just every season, but every 7 minutes in the show. It's like, I imagine they'd held a meeting and said, look, come on, someone's going to have to sort this out. We're going to have no cast members left. But you do have that moment of feeling just that sense of being the last one standing.
Yeah.
It's 28 days later. It's, you know, the apocalypse. It's just me then. All those things. And if you're not careful, that can lead you down a path of self-pity, I think. Even though I would have felt entitled, you know, in fairness, I think saying to someone, stop feeling sorry for yourself when the whole family's died, you know,
yeah.
I was allowed to, but I didn't think that was a positive way to live. And I thought that was an insult to my family. But I genuinely think what happens when you lose people, I feel with my sister, I never felt as good as her. My dad said the best has gone when she died, and that cut me inside. And now I feel in many ways she did lead a better life than me. But I feel now that she's gone, all that goodness hasn't disappeared. And I think the legacy it's left in me is it's made me kinder and more compassionate. Because I think when you lose someone, it changes you so fundamentally. And I think something of them gets wrapped up inside you in the changes that you make in your life. That's their legacy. They live on in you.
Mm. And so what we didn't discover in that conversation, but I can tell you now, is that Emily got herself a lovely dog, a Shih Tzu called Raymond, who very much helped her. And she also did something called the Hoffman process, which she found really, really helpful. But Rongan, you must have people coming to see you all the time who are dealing with grief. And it's something that can have huge effects on you physically and mentally. And I thought it was really interesting how she was saying that she was able to move on eventually. It took time. But something about that, taking that positivity from her sister and wanting to do justice to her life by slightly changing how she lived her own.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, as a doctor, I've, you know, experienced patients dying, you know, helping people through loved ones dying. But as I was listening to that, it took me back, because it's almost 7 years since my dad died. This March will be 7 years. And, you know, some of the things that she was saying about, you know, you're almost preparing for a race that you don't want to come. It was amazing, because it really took me back, and I thought, wow, this is how we were like for years, and certainly the final few months before Dad died. And I've gone through my own reflective process since my dad died. Probably, you know, it's a bit obvious really, but it probably one of the most significant moments in my entire life, you know, to lose a parent, and then all the kind of inner thinking that I did after that. And I can very much resonate with that sort of idea that, you know, my dad was an immigrant here. He worked really hard. He worked two jobs. I think he killed himself working to give his family and me and my brother a great start in life and a great upbringing. And I remember in the few months after Dad died thinking, Dad felt like he had to do that. And I think he has given me a great start in life. For me now, if I do the same thing, if I overwork and I do all the stuff that I don't need to do, then wouldn't that be a tragedy that I don't learn from my dad's life? So, you know, not quite the same thing, but certainly a common theme there, where I think that we can use grief, we can use death to, you know, to make us think and reflect how grateful we are that, yeah, we are still here, and what can we learn from someone's death. So yeah, sure, many I can, I think I'll probably be processing that later today as well, because it was quite a poignant piece there.
It made me think of a friend who lost her sibling earlier this year, and she, during that process, while her sister was very poorly, she actually got a horse. And for her, that was the best thing that could have happened, because eventually when her sister did pass away, she had this companion that she had to be kind of mucking out and seeing twice a day. So actually for her, keeping that routine and a bit of normality was the best thing that ever could have happened, really, out of such a sad situation.
You need that, otherwise if you're just left to just sit there and think and ruminate, it's very difficult. Another metaphor she used was, she said it's a bit like glitter. If you've had a sort of glitter bomb go off in your house and you hoover it up, grief, you think you've kind of got rid of it, and then every day you find another little bit. There'll be something that will remind you, and so it will never quite go away.
What I found super helpful, that's something I talk to my patients a lot about these days, is the importance of time, but the importance of downtime. And I think this is particularly an issue these days, as we have, you know, we've got these supercomputers in our pockets. And so I know after downtime, I spent a lot of time when I could, I'd just go and walk. Mm. I could just go and walk without a device. And I would just think, and I think, you know, looking back now, I think that really helped me process things. And I think had I walked with a device or sat there just numbing my feelings with endless scrolling through social media, I imagine that would have impacted my ability to actually process some of those deep feelings. Because I think, you know, on another level, I think that is something that many of us are doing in our daily lives. And I, you know, I'm not talking about grief per se, but we're not spending enough time alone with our thoughts, because it's never been easier not to. And therefore, a lot of the time, you know, we can tell people to, oh, they're scrolling too much, let's say on Instagram, for example. But actually, for some people, that's an escape. Some people, that's a way of not dealing with the reality of their life, because it gives you a bit of escapism. Mm. And it's something I, as a doctor, this whole piece of connection, I talk about it a lot. In fact, you know, in this sort of 5-minute program that I talk about with patients, I deal with what I consider three aspects of health. Body, we've spoken about. Mind, which is things that you can do for your mental health each day. But I also have this section called heart. And this whole piece reminds me of that section, because I put it at the end of the book, but I say some of you may be skeptical, right? But this is the most important part of the book. 5 minutes each day to nurture your human connections, whether that's connections with your family, connections with your friends, with your partner, connection with yourself. Let's give an example. One of the things, because I follow this plan, this Feel Better in 5 plan in my own life. It's how I stay fit and well when I'm super busy like many people. One of the 5-minute recommendations that you might want to consider in the heart section is something called a tea ritual, right? And it sounds so simple, right? But it's about something my wife and I do most nights. So, you know, relationships are under strain these days. You know, everyone's busy. Even when we are with the people that we love, whether it's kids or partner or friends, we're often distracted, mm-hmm. right? We're sort of half there, but we're sort of mentally a million miles away on our phone, whether it's our emails or it's who just sent me that message on Instagram. You know, we all know that feeling. And I found with patients, but also myself, 5 minutes of focused connection time with my wife each day transforms our relationship. So we put the kids to bed, clean up the kitchen, and before we go and do our sort of whatever we want to do, whether it's go on our phones or watch something or whatever it is, we sit down in the kitchen. It's called the tea ritual. Make a cup of tea, mint tea for us, because I'm not very good with caffeine in the evening. And we'll literally sit there in a clean kitchen for 5 minutes without our devices and talk about each other's days. Mm-hmm. It sounds so simple, but it has transformed the fabric of our relationship. We feel closer. We feel more connected with each other. It's so easy these days for people just to be passing ships in the night. And again, I've used this with many of my patients. So a lot of people have told me it saved their marriages. Mm. And you know, this is why I'm really passionate about these little 5-minute segments that we can do each day that don't take long. Ideally, 5 minutes for your mind, 5 minutes for your body, and 5 minutes for your heart. I think if people follow that, whether you're sick and really need help with your health, I think this plan will work. If you are trying to prevent getting sick in the future, I think it's the same plan that's going to work for you. And I think if you're someone who's actually generally pretty well, but is sort of sick and tired of always feeling knackered and needing caffeine to get you through each day, I think this same plan will help as well. It's the same, these fundamentals of good health. And I think what people are really going to like is the fact that I have given people 50 options in the book, right? But you just need to choose 3, 1 from each section, and do the same through every day. So the reason why you don't want to change it up each day is because that leads to procrastination. If you think, okay, I'm going to do a 5-minute workout today. Oh, I'm going to do one of his strength ones, or maybe I'll do a yoga one, or maybe I'll do a high intensity one. You know, that's indecision. Before you know it, you're like, oh God, I can't be bothered. I'll do it tomorrow, right? So I say initially stick to the same 3 every day at the same time. Mm. So yeah, I kind of feel I've really, I've got to say it was the hardest of my three books to write, this one. But I read the audiobook just a few weeks ago. I'd had a couple of months away from the book. And honestly, I was really, really pleased when I read the audiobook. You need a bit of time away.
Yeah.
And I really felt that I have distilled health down into the essence of how simple it can be. I'm not sure I could make health any simpler than I have in this book. And I really hope it helps the amount of people that I think it can help.
I think if my wife is listening to this, she will like the idea of the tea ritual, mainly because she likes tea.
There you go.
I think that could work.
But genuinely, right? No word of a lie. I challenge you to try it.
Oh, you don't need to. That sounds
try
great
it
to me.
5 days a week. Yeah. Try it for a week, just for the next 5 days, and just see what happens. Because people who do it tell me things in their relationship change without them even realize it. Like a couple are more affectionate with each other. They're just a bit more caring. It's this, we are starved of connection in the modern world. And once we get a bit of connection back, a lot of the downstream consequences just go away.
I'll have to report back. This could be a whole new podcast series.
Please do.
How's Will getting on? Well, look, we've spoken a lot about the sort of things that you can do, the action that you can do to improve your life. And as we were mentioning earlier, sometimes the pressure to do action can be overwhelming at the beginning of a new year because we try and take on too much. Through books like Matthew Walker's Why We Sleep, we've also learned the importance of things like sleep, getting a proper night's sleep to help not just our mental health, our physical health as well. What about rest, though? So in an increasingly hectic world, which we've also spoken about, taking time in our conscious hours to find rest is just as important, according to a new book, from Claudia Hammond called The Art of Rest. I spoke to her about what rest actually means and what things we can do to best aid our health. Bibliophiles will be very happy with what came out on top of the list.
Rest is something we need to value much more than we do. So people have started to take sleep much more seriously. But I think we need to take rest more seriously. And when I say rest, I mean when you're awake. So not having a nap, that doesn't count. Things that you do that feel restful while you're awake. Rest seems to have a huge impact on well-being. And with a group of psychologists from Durham University, we conducted what became the world's largest survey on rest, and 18,000 people from 135 different countries filled in this very long survey, explaining everything about why they wanted to rest, whether they wanted more rest, and the ways that they did it. And we analysed all that data. And we found that 2/3 of people said that they wanted more rest than they got now. And when we looked at the well-being scores of people, those who got enough rest, the lucky third who didn't want more rest, had well-being scores twice as high as those people who felt in need of more rest. And I think these days, many people just feel that overwhelmed with the number of things they have to do. You know, we've all got these to-do lists that are just far too long. And people also put some of those demands on themselves as well. And so people want to, you know, be brilliant cooks and be really fit and go and see lots of different things and do loads of things and do really well at work and make sure that they see their friends all the time. People want to do all of these different things and put some of these demands on themselves. And then lots of other external demands come on us as well. And so people do feel very, very busy these days. And now it's interesting when you look at time use surveys that they suggest that we haven't got less free time, in fact, than people had, say, in the 1950s, that people are just as busy, but it doesn't feel like that. And I think partly that's because we feel on call all the time. You know, our phones can interrupt us all the time. There's emails, there's a blurring of the boundaries between work and leisure, and that makes us feel more under pressure. So what we need to do is to try to carve out some time to rest and to find, for each of us individually, almost our own personal prescription for rest, to work out what are the activities that are really going to make me feel more rested. And so it's really important to take some time in the day to try to do that. And it doesn't have to mean sitting around doing nothing or you know, lying on a sofa. And in fact, many people find doing nothing difficult. I mean, we have a top 10 of the activities that people found the most restful. Doing nothing came in at number 5, so it wasn't the top activity. And many people find doing nothing so difficult that there was one study done in the States where people were asked to sit in a room for 15 minutes, a bare room. They couldn't have their phone and they weren't allowed to nap, and there was no book and nothing for them to do. They just had their own thoughts for 15 minutes. But one thing they did have available to them was a sort of ankle bracelet that could give them an electric shock if they chose to press the button on the computer. Now, they didn't have to do it, but they could choose whether to if they wanted to. And what was amazing was that almost three quarters of the men decided to give themselves at least one electric shock.
Rather than do nothing at all.
That's how hard it is to be do nothing and be alone with your thoughts for some people. 25% of women decided to give themselves an electric shock. I don't know what that tells us about men and women. Three times as many men thought this was a good thing to do. One man shocked himself 191 times. Obviously enjoyed it. But, masochists apart, I think it does tell us something about how difficult we find it to do nothing. Mm. So when I'm talking about rest, I'm not saying you have to do nothing. And in fact, 38% of people told us that they found going for a walk really restful. 8% found running restful and said that they needed to tire out their bodies in order to switch their minds off, that their minds were still racing with things unless they had something really absorbing. And number one was reading, which was interesting because we were quite surprised, because reading takes some effort, and we know that within the brain, you know, the brain has to do all sorts of things in order to read. It's got to look at those words, make sense of those words, make the sense of those words in relation to the words that have gone before them, and in terms of your other thoughts and your memories and experiences. And reading really seems to take people out of themselves. So it's a way of escaping, but it's also a way of allowing you to reflect on your own life as well. So some people might read and think about what they would do in those situations. You start to empathise and you put yourself in the situation, say, if it's fiction of characters. Mm. But non-fiction has been found to be just as relaxing for people to read. So it doesn't have to be fiction if people prefer non-fiction. And people also don't have to be concentrating all the time. So it is okay, I shouldn't say this as someone who writes books, it is okay to let your mind wander while you read.
Yeah.
And there've been really interesting experiments tracking people's eye movements, and you can tell that people, that their mind is wandering, even though their eyes carry on going along the lines and down the page, that they're not taking it in and not thinking about it, because one, people's rate of blinking changes if they're not concentrating, and the other is that usually people's eye movements slow down over long, difficult words and people, or unfamiliar words, and people have to think about those a bit. And you can detect that if you track people's eye movements, and they stay at this steady rate when people are not concentrating. And it's known as mindless reading within the psychological literature. Mm. But that's fine too. So in a way, a book is a really good jumping off point for daydreaming. And daydreaming was another one in the top 10, because it's another thing that allows us to get away from our worries for a while. So daydreaming is problematic if people are ruminating about negative things constantly. But daydreaming, where you stare out of the window and just think about other things than what you're supposed to be thinking about, seems to be a very restful experience and a good thing for people. We know that people don't tend to find other people that restful. So the top five activities were all things people tend to do on their own. And in fact, socialising with friends and chatting with family things like socialising with friends and chatting with family didn't come in the top 10, which was quite interesting, even when we separated it and just looked at the extroverts. Even the extroverts, for restfulness, they may enjoy it, but for restfulness, want to get away from people. But reading is perfect for that, because you have the company of those characters, so you needn't feel alone if you don't want to feel alone. But they don't demand anything from you. You can pay attention to them when you want to, and then you can close the book when you want to, and then you can come back to them when you want to, and you don't owe them anything. They don't expect anything from you. And so I think that's why reading can be so restful.
I think it was Hemingway who said, "There is no friend as loyal as a book."
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. They'll never leave you.
Taking our cue from that final thought, it is time to hear now from our booksellers as they give us their book recommendations based on this theme of changes.
Hi, my name's Nick from Waterstones Piccadilly. The book I recommend on the theme of changes is All Among the Barley by Melissa Harrison. It's about a young woman in a village in Suffolk in the 1930s, dissatisfied with her lot, and change comes to her and her village in an unusual and unexpected form.
Hi, this is Katrina from Glasgow, and my recommendation on the subject of changes is Queenie by Candace Carty-Williams. It's the story of a young woman who's stuck on self-destruct and her finding her way back to caring about herself and her life. It's really funny, poignant, and absolutely filthy. I loved it.
So there we go. We've had bookseller recommendations based on changes. We've had different ideas about what change actually means. Rangan, I can't thank you enough for your insight into how we can make huge changes in our lives with actually small actions every day.
Guys, well, look, thank you very much for inviting me on. And genuinely, I am a huge fan of places like Waterstones. My family and I were often in our local Waterstones most weekends. I think it's a great thing for my kids to do. Look at books in real life, in person, touch them. You know, these sort of things. And they're all really in keeping with what I believe in. So thanks very much for having me on.
An absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Holly, what do you think you're going to be doing for your health in the new year?
The 5 minutes of rest, maybe.
Something we can all sign up to. In our next episode, we're going to be exploring the theme of adaptation, speaking to three authors who have all seen their books turned into other things. So join us as we hear from RJ Palacio, Neil Gaiman, and Margaret Atwood. We'll see you then.